You're tuned in to Positively Terrible. I'm producer Dan, and each week my buddy Scott and I discuss surviving and thriving after trauma. It's a journey that started when Scott, his wife's fiance, and her boyfriend all walked into a bar. This week's decent human being is Kelly. She's got a fucked up story about quiet trauma. Settle in, my terrible listeners. Today's episode is going to be positively terrible. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Dan. How you doing?
I'm pretty good, man. How are you this week?
Pretty good, but I fucked up.
No surprise there. What'd you do?
So I've mentioned Baloney on here before, my dog.
Yeah, I know that guy.
He's been up and down with his health, and before I even got him, he'd had his own traumatic experience that I'd put up against anybody else's traumatic experiences.
Yeah, that dog's been through a lot.
He's been through some shit, so I might spoil him a little bit. And over the last year and a half since I've gotten him, he's gained a bunch of weight. We determined that he had an actual real-life thyroid issue, put him on some medication, and he gained some more weight. Okay, so I told my vet, I was like, I give him too many treats. And she, first of all, she did say he still shouldn't have gained weight. So let's decrease the treats, but let's double his medication too. So I didn't buy his favorite treat for the last couple of weeks, and I bought them tonight. It is a chicken jerky, and this fucking thing just goes nuts for this chicken jerky. Now I remember why I was giving him too many treats, because this dog won't leave me alone when he knows there is chicken jerky in this house. He runs to the kitchen, runs back. This dog has never run at any other point that I've had him, but he runs to the kitchen, runs back, runs to the kitchen, runs back, runs to the kitchen again, and pisses on the floor because I haven't gotten him a treat. And this is what I'm going to go through. So, Dan, if Lando wants a bag of chicken jerky, maybe I should just pass him off to you and make it your problem.
Well, funny you should say that, because Lando got some chicken jerky I think it was turkey jerky
First
time this week, because it was Lando's birthday.
Okay.
Just a few days ago. And have you ever tried the chicken jerky?
No, I have not.
Well, Lando's turkey jerky smelled so good that I did try it. And it was pretty good. I could have eaten more, but I just had enough.
All right, Kelly, do you have a favorite brand of dog treat?
I don't, because in the household I grew up in, there were no such things as dog treats.
Oh, okay. All right. Were there dogs? Just no dog
there
treats?
There was the runt of a miniature poodle litter, so she was about, you know, no longer than your arm. You could pick her up in one hand.
Okay.
She All was right. scared of rabbits, so.
Scared of rabbits. All right. Well, she might have been scared of chicken jerky also. We don't know, but I can tell you that her life was probably better for not having this stupid treat in the house, because it is like crack, and I wish that I hadn't done it. But, Kelly, do you have any pets now?
I do. I actually have two cats, and they're a little spoiled.
Okay.
They aren't overly food motivated, so they don't get treats. They just chase each other around and pounce on each other.
Yeah. That's good. And I've got three cats myself.
Remy will come up and talk into the microphone, because that's what she likes to do when the microphone's out.
Nice. Well, I hope we hear from her today.
Yeah, we are not against that. We are animal people. So if they want to make an appearance, I think that most of our fans are also, or listeners, fans might be a strong word. I don't know if we got any fans.
Real strong.
But they I think we have a lot of animal lovers that listen to us as well. So Kelly, you have experienced quiet trauma. That's a term we have not used here on this show before. Could you tell us a little bit about what that is, what that means?
Yeah. So, when we talk about trauma, a lot of times we talk about the obvious physical violence. that many people experience, whether it's medical violence or they've been in an accident or they've been around horrible adults or people who do beady, hitty things with their bodies. A lot of people also experience what I like to call quiet traumas, which are either mismatches in how like our parents relate to us, so we feel like we're not understood as people, or just emotionally abusive people. And I call them quiet traumas because they're a heck of a lot harder to confirm that they ever happened to you.
That is relatable. And I find myself questioning often whether or not some things that I've thought were abuse in my marriage, whether or not they were actually abuse. And at times, well, I'll ask you, instead of just saying how I feel, does it ever make you feel silly? Like, that's what it makes me feel silly. Like, it wasn't that bad. Oh, it wasn't that. It wasn't abuse.
I still don't use the abuse word.
Okay, to be honest with you. Fair enough. I should have said trauma instead of abuse.
Yeah, I call it trauma because I grew up in a place, in an environment in which I'm a very intellectual person with me, but my connection needs weren't met as a kid. My parents just weren't able to provide the physical contact and the emotional regulation support that I needed as a kid. So I grew up feeling really alone, even though I lived in the same house with three other human beings and a dog. And my parents weren't being mean and they weren't out of control. So I don't call it abuse, but it was traumatic as fuck.
Yeah, for sure. And again, apologies for using abuse. Let's talk about that then. Let's talk about your childhood then. What was your childhood like?
It was actually a really lonely childhood. I have a younger brother, and he is lovely, and he's still alive today. He made it out. But when he was born very, very ill. He had his first surgery within 2 hours. He was expected to live 2 days, then 2 months, then 2 years, and then he was supposed to be stupid. To say the least, he's a 40-something-year-old man who's a smartass. So he's alive and well, but my childhood went from being something that was relatively quiet and disconnected to something that was really quiet and disconnected, because my parents' whole focus became keeping this kid alive.
Okay. And are you the younger or older
sibling? I am the older one. So I am not only the girl and all the expectations that go along with being an older sister, I'm the oldest sister. So there was a lot of time spent caring for him, which I don't begrudge. What makes me pissy is it made me feel at the time like I was invisible.
You said a lot of time spent taking care of. Did you mean that your parents were giving that attention to him, or that you were also taking care of him?
So my parents were, especially when he was really young, spent a lot of time taking care of him.
Okay.
And our schedule, we had a really regimented schedule that was set by his meds, because his meds required us to eat at certain times. So he had fasting meds so that he could then take his meds and then it would be good. So we had a really regimented schedule. And then I will say the one thing my parents did do is I had what I would consider a normal level of older sister expectations for taking care of younger siblings. But I wasn't expected to really do any medical care or any extra care beyond that.
Okay. Well, that's good. And how old were you when he was born?
I was three.
Okay. So you probably don't have a whole heck of a lot of memories then of a life without him, I'm guessing.
No, I don't. Mainly because our memories don't start encoding until a little later.
Right.
Or don't encode in a way that's logical and chronicle and have language until later anyway. So I don't have a lot of memories of life without him. But I can tell you that the disconnect I felt was already there before he showed up on the scene. So his presence made it more terrible. It didn't cause the terrible.
Did they know before he was brought into the world? Did they know that he was sick?
No, because actually him being born sick meant my father then got diagnosed with the same disease, and then I got diagnosed with the same disease.
Oh, wow.
So it's a mind fuck all the way around.
How were they able to diagnose him so early? It sounds like, I mean, you said he had surgery very soon after he was born.
Right.
So it manifested in a different way in him?
Yeah. So it's one of those diseases that occurs on a continuum from absolutely terrible to unnoticeable or barely noticeable. Like people studying for their PEDS boards can notice it if I tell them, but most people wouldn't notice that I have it.
Okay.
And it was a relatively new disease in 1978. So we're talking, 40 years ago.
Sure. And what are kind of your memories then about how your parents had to care for him and how that affected you?
So probably the biggest memory that I have, because I honestly don't have a lot of childhood memories.
Okay.
Which is one of the common occurrences for people with childhood trauma. But one of the memories I have is standing in the hall downstairs outside the bathroom and looking on as my parents had my brother on the good table in our living room that we ate Christmas dinner at. At the time was covered with medical supplies and they were clean. He came home with something attached to his stomach. I still don't know what it is because I don't care, quite frankly. And they had to suction him out until we're suctioning stuff out. And it was both of them just huddled around and focused right on my brother for, 15 to 20 minutes or half an hour at a time. I mean, you're a little kid. You don't know how long anything is. And a lot of it just was the conversations. Like what I do remember, the conversations were about what we had to do to keep him alive and like what the schedule had to be to make sure that he got his meds.
Okay. And did your parents talk to you much about the disease then and how it affected your brother and later they found out that it affected you?
Not necessarily directly. I did have conversations with my mom when I was a teenager. Those car conversations that you have with your parents. I don't know. The only time I had good conversations with my mom was in the car.
Okay.
Except for one Christmas Eve one that we just won't talk about because that was just a nightmare.
So there's some bad ones too. Okay.
There's some bad ones. But we had a car conversation one day and she was like, she was talking about how it was like awful to realize that she had given birth to these kids who had this awful disease and it kind of destroyed her life. And anybody who would marry me would be taking on quite a bit of, expectations and possible danger. So like it just kind of infused her whole idea about what my life could be and what it would look like.
Yeah.
Jeez, that's a heavy conversation.
Yeah, I was 15.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful conversation. There's a reason I'm single at 48.
Well, beautiful is one word for that conversation.
I can imagine that your mom must have been in a very difficult place and a very unhappy place for a very long time.
She was, and it was a struggle. I mean, knowing how she grew up, or knowing a little bit about how she grew up, she wasn't great at the emotional connection piece to begin with.
Clearly.
She didn't have the kind of support that kids need to have great emotional connections with their kids. So she had no idea how to talk to kids.
Yeah.
And by the time I was 15, I was just an adult in a smaller body.
Well, I don't know how to talk to adults yet. I think I prefer my time with children quite often until I get tired of them and I'm just thrilled to give them back to their parents, specifically my niece and nephew. I don't have a lot of other kids who are under my care. but yeah, Kelly, that sounds rough. And at the time, did you have an understanding that life in your household was maybe not the same as it was in other people's and your friends and households?
I understood that it was different. I didn't understand it was traumatic. Like, it's kind of hard when your brother's that sick for it to not be different.
For sure.
What I didn't understand was how closed off and how unemotionally available either one of my parents were.
When did you start to realize that?
I was 43.
Okay. And
because I lived for a really, this is why I call them the quiet traumas. I lived for a really long time believing the story that because I had a roof over my head and food on the table, my parents never hit me. It was okay.
Mm-hmm.
It was okay that I had to learn how to control my anger by myself. It was okay that I had to, you know, assemble dinner 4 nights a week. It was okay that my mom stopped working second shift and kicked me out of the role I'd made for myself when I was in high school.
What do you mean the role you made for yourself?
So my mom worked second until I was in high school, which meant that my dad did most of the after-school parenting.
Okay.
So my mom would plan these, would do the meal planning, and two or three nights a week, you know, after I was like 10 or 12, I would make dinner. I had this place that I'd made where I could be of service to my family. So I was welcome and people would talk to me and they had a reason to talk to me. That my mom decided was too much parentification.
Mm-hmm.
But that wouldn't have been the language she put to it. It was just, I was just doing too much adult stuff.
Sure.
So she switched to first shift so that I didn't have to do quite so much of it, not realizing that by that point, she was then kicking me out of a place I felt safe.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I guess my question for that is, do you feel like then that role is kind of where you got felt your value? That's where you felt that you brought something to the table?
It is. It's one of those struggles I still face today is that I'm working on it. That if I don't bring something to the room, then there's no reason for me to be in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's kind of like one of the stories in my childhood that I'm still challenged by some days.
Okay. Do you think that you're upbringing, the way your parents were a little bit more closed off, do you think that there is something generational about that as well? And the reason I say that is because I often hear people say that, you know, Gen X, we were raised feral, and have a lot of comments about the way that our parents did things. And
right.
Do you think there were some generational things there as well?
Well, I'm definitely Gen X, and my father is a member, was one of the, at the tail end of the Lost Generation, because he was born in 1945.
Okay.
My mom was a boomer. I think a lot of it is the slide away from community. That we've experienced in the United States in the last 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the automobile, we've expanded so much and our churches are no longer within walking distances. Our churches are 20 minutes away. Even the one I went to growing up, my schools were within walking distance, but all of my parents' friends were not parents of kids I went to school with.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have a friend group to run around with and cause chaos with.
Right.
I consider myself to be emotionally feral because my parents were really rigid about where I could go and what I could do. So that whole vagueness of being out in public and doing all kinds of crazy things that a lot of Gen X people experience, I didn't get to experience.
Okay.
Because I had to be home by the time when the streetlights came on, I had to be home within 2 minutes. Right.
Right.
And there were expectations about how far away I was. but my parents weren't available to help me emotionally learn how to settle myself down and find my own sense of comfort.
Yeah, I get that. And you mentioned, you know, the automobile, and I look at the time from 1900 to 1980 and think how much things changed in those 80 years compared to any time before it. And sometimes I look at things like we kind of evolved as a society faster than we, you know, we've got to catch up and learn how to behave and act and parent and conform to that society. And there was a time when, you know, I look at like fast food, like I love fast food. I ate way too much fast food. I ate it as a kid. And I think there was a time when we had moms working for the first time ever, this new thing that makes meals quick. And a lot of us learned some bad food lessons because of it. That's just one example. But I think that there was a time that so much was changing and society takes a generation or two to catch up to those changes. And
that's a really great way to kind of frame it, because what happened is that my dad had some emotional capacity. It just was relatively limited because he did not sleep well. So that's a whole nother problem.
Okay.
But he had a friend group, and he had that emotional capacity in a way where smaller communities that aren't interrupted by the advent of the car in the United States. That's why I pinpoint the car.
Sure.
Is that his neighbors raised him. Like, if he got in trouble, his mom was gonna know.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I came from a very small town, a tighter community. And I will tell you that if I got in any trouble, and I didn't, but if I got in any trouble back then, my parents would have known. So let's kind of jump to how this upbringing and the quiet trauma, how did that manifest in you? How did that change your life?
Well, it made me a very isolated person. It was really hard for me to trust anybody. So I went off to college, and I managed to make a great group of friends my freshman year in college. Go Norton Rats.
I was just thinking that.
but I made a great group of friends, and then my father died my freshman year in college.
Oh, wow.
And I kind of, like, the sense of safety, whatever sense of safety I had, kind of dissipated. So I basically, other than the people I already knew, I had cut myself off from meeting new people. So by the time I was 25, I was living in, where was I living at 25? I was living here in Atlanta.
Okay.
And I didn't have any friends. I went to work every day and I did my grocery shopping and I came home.
Was this your way of kind of closing yourself off?
Yeah, I was pretty much on lockdown. I didn't have any friends. I avoided my emotions whenever I could. I did whatever I could to distract myself. The wonderful clinical term, if you're looking for it, is dissociate. I was an excellent dissociator.
Okay.
I could do it without the benefit of chemicals. So I read a lot. I wasn't engaged with the world at all.
And did you realize that at the time, or is that also something that took until your 40s?
I realized it at the time because 9/11 happened when I was 26.
Okay.
And I was sitting in my car, the second row from the right on 85 South, right in front of the Lucent Technology Building. And when I heard the news on the radio, all I could think to myself was, they should stop reading Tom Clancy novels.
So you thought it was a War of the Worlds situation on the radio? Is that what you're saying?
No, I was just like, they should stop reading Tom Clancy novels. Oh my God, this is awful. They should stop reading Tom Clancy novels.
And have you campaigned to get people to stop reading these Tom Clancy novels? Or was no, that just a fucking thought?
I actually enjoyed them. Richard Sherman is better, but Tom Hanks is not bad.
I won't debate you on that.
But it's just the idea that I was so locked off from the world. And like, by that time, I'd almost hit my roommate. So I was in therapy. And when I told my therapist, like, this is really all I can think about this. He just kind of looked at me and shook his head and said, yeah, that's a problem. Like, I know.
Okay, so that pushed you into a realization about yourself? Yeah. Okay.
It pushed me into a realization, and I did a lot of what would be called cognitive work, like CBT and DBT, and like doing some thought processing work around
it.
But it took another 20 some years until I actually ended up to a point where I felt mostly whole and I wasn't quite so isolated and shut off from the world.
Okay. Did you start making strides at that point and it just been a long journey, or do you feel like it wasn't really effective in that way early on?
A little bit of both. So I started, I went through a series of new peer groups. So I was in a church at the time and I eventually left that church. I did improv for about 2.5 years.
Okay.
Eventually stopped doing that. I ended up in the BDSM community, which was really helpful for getting back into my body. Cause if you want your body to tell you it's there, just give it some pain.
Okay.
And I've since found friends and and other folks, within the trauma communities that I'm a part of, in addition to the people I've carried along the way. Okay. But it wasn't until I found a way back into my body that felt like the great big, like, leap for me. Because I did 15 years of cognitive work. I did it. But I still felt like a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad person.
Well, Kelly, I want to interrupt right here.
Okay.
Because I want to commend you for something. I see and hear a lot of adults who talk about how hard it is to make friends and often say, well, I don't even know how. I don't know. Where the fuck do I go? And to hear you say that you did improv, you were in the BDSM community, you found a way. Was this intentional? What, looking for your people?
It was intentional in the sense that I decided that I needed more people and I went looking for more people.
Okay. Well, and that's what I was getting at. That is something that is hard. And you hear a lot about it, especially post-pandemic. So it's almost funny that you're saying, like, only recently have you kind of found yourself, when there's this epidemic of kind of loneliness, from what I understand, that has only gotten worse from the time of the pandemic. And there's been a lot of isolation. And like for me, and I know Dan, our company, the one I used to work at, the one he currently does, went remote. And for me, holy shit, it became very easy to order my groceries, go online for work, do things that did not require me to leave the house. And to hear that you, back, you know, going, dating back 15, 20 years, whatever it was, were seeking something and doing something about it, that's impressive to me. So I think that, you know, I'm glad you found your place, but God damn it, I'm proud of you for putting in that work.
Thank you. And the one thing I will say is that it's a choice I've had to make over and over again. Mm-hmm. I made the choice to try something new more times than I can count. Well, I can probably count the big ones on two hands, but I've had to make that choice more than once. because I look at each one of the communities I've been a member, a part of, including the spiritual one I'm a part of right now. And stepping into each one of those communities was like, I am agreeing to be uncomfortable for probably 6 to 8 months. Because I am slow to find comfort.
Yeah.
I am agreeing to be uncomfortable for 6 to 8 months because I know I need people.
And that is amazing to me. Putting yourself out there in that way, not just knowing that it's hard, but knowing that you're getting into a level of discomfort that makes people not do it.
The problem is nothing changes if you can't sit in the discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing changes.
I agree. And nothing changes if you didn't put in all the other work that you were putting in therapy and the different techniques that you were trying. So I think that you're just a great example of it might take some time, but it's worth it.
And yeah.
I think that's what I'm hearing. Okay. So when you got to this point and you said it was very recent, did you realize it? Were you sitting there like today, like, oh, I'm here, I made it?
Ooh, have I ever, I never think I made it.
Okay.
If I'm honest about it, there are moments I've sat in a group of people, I'm like, oh, I belong here. Which is just beautiful. And
yeah, it is.
Those are the moments I cherish, but I don't ever think I made it.
Well, I'll tell you what, when I pull up to someplace, when I'm driving I'm using my Google GPS and it says, you have arrived. Every time I say, damn right I have. I acknowledge it in the moment. I got where I was going, where I needed to be. And it sounds like you have. I mean, maybe not. Maybe you'll never be all the way there. But Jesus, you're going the right direction. And it sounds like it feels pretty fucking good. So when you look back at your journey now,
mm-hmm.
What do you think?
I think I'm really glad I didn't stop after the first place didn't work out.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. Do you feel a sense of pride or just like it had to be this way?
For me, it had to be this way. I'm a retired recovering engineer. So the pride thing is a little hard for me.
Okay. Well, we'll feel it for you.
That's excellent. I'm all for people feeling that one for me.
Okay. All right. So is there anything that you have learned along the way that you can share with the audience?
Yeah, the steps don't have to be big.
Okay.
The steps don't have to be big. So my favorite way of trying something new is to take a class. And sometimes I show up and I'm just all the versions of me that are public and loud. And sometimes I show up and I'm a pretty classic introvert and I sit and I watch for 6 months. Like my introduction to the BDSM community, it's kind of a joke among my friends because I didn't say more than 10 words at any place I went for about a year and a half.
Okay.
Not. Because I was just watching and getting a sense of where I was, but it's the repeated small steps that we can make that are really helpful.
Yeah. And what do you do when you take a step or try something and you feel like it didn't work? Like it's a misstep.
You apply design principles.
And could you elaborate, please, Kelly?
Yes, I can. So this is where an engineering brain gets you out of trouble a little bit. So when things don't work, you go, huh, that didn't work. Well, okay, first you swear.
Right. Oh, first yes. You swear.
And then you go, huh, that didn't work. And then you go, why didn't that work? What about this didn't work out for me? So when I was in the church I was in my mid-20s, didn't work out for me. And it didn't work out for me because it expected me to fit into a box that I became less willing to fit into.
Okay.
Right. But it wasn't until I had stepped away and looked at it and really went, oh, yeah, that didn't work because they were trying to fit me into a box. So I went looking for a place that wasn't going to try and that had boxes, but didn't think everybody needed to be in the same box. Yeah.
So a little bit of a postmortem here, looking at it and saying, what happened? Why didn't this work? What made me uncomfortable? Yeah. And how do I avoid that the next time?
Yep. It's actually two questions because you've got to ask the flip side of that question too. You have to ask what did work about it.
Oh, that's a good one. That
because if you don't know both, you don't, because you need what did work too.
Sure. Sure.
Right. And we have as humans, we have a regular inbuilt a bias toward negativity. Mm-hmm. So we also need to look at what did work. So when I look at my church experience, I'm like, oh, I have people who let me show up the way I was going to show up that given day.
Okay.
Now, for various reasons, they stopped being part of my experience within that community, which is one of the reasons I left. But I went then looking for spaces that had people who let me show up the way I was going to show up on a given day. So you've got to ask both questions.
Yeah. No, that's great. And what I'm hearing is a lot of living your life with intention, being cerebral, thinking about it. Because a lot of us just show up. And showing up is not a bad thing. It can be better than not showing up. But I know that I have only realized that in the last several years of my life, is that life isn't something you just show up to and expect everything to fall into place. That it takes a lot of work to get you there. And those failures can lead to something big.
And yeah, it requires reflection.
Now, for sure.
I'm a huge proponent on just, like, if you don't know, show up. It'll give you information. You can make a choice after that. Yeah. But if you just, if you don't do the reflection piece, you don't know what you need to change.
Yeah, for sure. And even I think the way you're showing up, though, is intentional. Even if, like you just said, you may not know, but you reflect later. You've got a process, a plan. And I think that we would have guessed at some point that you were an engineer of some sort if you had not told us. Now, Kelly, what else are you into? This is about the thriving after the experiences. And I mean, first of all, we're painting a picture here and I love what we're painting and it's been a beautiful growth from you, but what else is going on that you would just say, hey, look at me, I'm Kelly and I'm thriving.
So I've also been doing quite a bit of writing as of late.
Okay.
I created an entire paradigm for understanding what it means to be a human being because I had to figure it out. I grew up in a way that I didn't know what the parts of being human were, and I don't fucking like roles. I want to be an integrated person, so what does it mean to be an integrated person? So I created a whole paradigm for that.
Yeah, well, Kelly, I like it, but I missed a word or two. I did not hear a paradigm to being a decent fucking human. I just heard a paradigm for, you know what? I will create that paradigm myself.
Okay.
And Kelly, is when you say that you're writing and you created a paradigm, is this something that you are making public or you may have made available for others?
The paradigm's actually public and on my website.
Okay.
It's actually called the Life Support Paradigm.
Okay.
Because even though I'm an engineer, I have a language problem, and that is there's a shit ton of language I hate.
Sure, I get it.
And I hate the word self-care.
Okay.
Because I am terrible at caring for myself.
God, I'm sorry, I reacted. A lot of us feel that way.
I get into fights about the fact that I am allowed to have self-care. So after 20 years of fighting with myself, I just decided I wanted a new language.
Okay.
So I created a life support paradigm.
All right.
Which is an understanding of about six areas of our lives that we can look into to discern what we need to do or acquire or get access to support the lives we want to live.
Okay, cool. And where can our listeners find this?
It can be found on secularshepherdess.life.
Secularshepherdess, hard for me to say, .life. We will absolutely share that for you, and we'll share anything else, your Instagram or Facebook, if you use those, LinkedIn, whatever social media you use to get it out there, we'll share it. Do you have one thing from this paradigm that is kind of your favorite thing that you'd want, that you're willing to share? I know there might be stuff in there that you want to say, hey, you got to read this, but is there something you want to share from it that you're particularly proud of, or you think is a particularly helpful for our listeners?
The thing I really love about it is it can be as big or as small as you want it to be.
Okay.
How and so? It's anchored in the here and now in a way that a lot of the ways we try to think about our lives holistically isn't. And okay. it talks about our emotions and our energy and our bodies and how we connect to people and even how we nourish ourselves and in a really integrated yet pieced out way that for me really works because I'm a systems person.
Okay. Okay. As I said, I think we are catching on to that. So if your brain works like Kelly's, or even if it doesn't, check it out. Again, I will post it in the show notes and we'll share it on Instagram and everything. Yeah. So you will know how you can get it. But yeah. Kelly, I have enjoyed this immensely. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Kelly, we're humbled and grateful that you're willing to share. It's something that I really do want to get out and say these words, because it is a difficult thing to do. And without you and, you know, our guests, we wouldn't have a show. So we're so appreciative of it. And lastly, you know, the one thing that I can't get away without saying is you passed the decent fucking human test. So
yay.
So thank you for being here again. And terrible.
You have arrived.
You have arrived. And terrible listeners, as always, remember that you can follow us on social media, Facebook and Instagram at Positively Terrible. You can send us an email if you want to be on the show, or if you want to get the decent fucking human tattoo.
Don't do it.
I'm still going to pay for 5 people to do it. I've got like 8 who've told me they're going to do it, but one of them is going
8
to get the ball rolling.
Who you've
one of
to.
Them is going to get the ball rolling. So we're going to get some people with the tattoo, but yeah, reach out to us if you wanted to match with match. Are we on Tinder here? If you want to follow us, if you want to talk to us, tell your story.
Find us on Tinder. We'll be there. Me and Scott together. Swipe right.
This wrapping up the show is a mess right now, but what I can say is that, as always, this has been absolutely, positively terrible. I met you back at Tonica's Fest. I confess I was nervous and stressed because I thought you were the best. I was right. And that night we got into a water-gun fight. That I won, I shot you in the face. It was fate. I offered you a spring. You declined. I said, keep it, you might decide to change your mind. You did. Thank you.
Positively Terrible is a part of the Terrible Podcast Network.